everyone. Welcome to the Introduction to Clinical Research podcast. My name is Debbie. I use she, her pronouns. I work in clinical research and I have decided to explain it to my friend, Elise. She can be your friend too, if you ask her. Say hello, Elise.
Hello, Elise. I use she, her pronouns and I guess I can be your friend if you ask me. So thanks, Debbie, for volunteering.
You've got a bunch of new friends.
I have so many new friends. Welcome. You know what? I won't keep in touch. Sorry.
Wow, my mom's gonna be mad at you.
Yeah, I'm just bad at it.
Oh yeah, who isn't? Like all of the ways that we have to keep in touch with each other now compared to like in the olden days when you had to write letters or send smoke signals or whatever.
Yeah.
And we're still not good at it.
No.
Anyhow, we're here to pull the curtain back on medical research, so hopefully you feel more informed, that you can trust the outcomes of research, and that you maybe know what those news stories are going on about. There's a lot we can discuss, and we're going to dive straight in today to my favourite topic. This is what happens when I'm in charge of picking the topics, is I pick this one. We're talking more about documentation. Yeah, because I went and talked about other topics for like 5 minutes, so now I get to go back to my favourite, the paperwork.
Yeah. Paperwork.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. If you haven't already listened to episode 8, I recommend that you do so, because we're kind of going to build on today what we learned in that episode about documentation. But if, you know, you don't want to, or like Elise, for you it was 1,000 years ago and your brain has maybe forgotten some of it.
My brain?
I don't want to assume,
doesn't
Elise.
Forget things, Debbie. Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. Oh, the look you just gave me.
Yeah, luckily nobody else can see it.
I'm sure they can imagine.
Feeling the attack.
I'm sure they can imagine. But let's be real. It's on lock up here.
Yes. Yeah, you've never forgotten anything, not once in your whole life.
No, never.
I know. All right. So here's your 2-minute primer. If, unlike Elise, mm-hmm. your brain isn't a safe for all information you've ever heard. Wow. Okay. So, documentation is extremely necessary as evidence of how a study is conducted. It's there so that people can reconstruct and understand what happened in a study at a later point in time. It's evidence of compliance. It's evidence of good practice. Documents are held by the sponsor. The sponsor is the company that funds and manages the study, in the Trial Master File, or TMF, and at each clinical site, hospital or etc., in the Investigator Site File, ISF. Some documents are held in both places, so the two files, TMF and ISF, mirror each other. Some are only held at the clinical site, some are only at the sponsor. For example, any patient confidential information, anything with the patient's name, address, etc., will never go to the sponsor. It will only ever live at the site. That's a way that we protect the patients. The golden rule of GCP. GCP, Elise, stands for...
Good clinical practice.
You see? It really is on lock.
Yeah. Elephant.
Like an elephant. Jink. The golden rule of GCP. If it isn't documented, it didn't happen. The expectation in clinical research is you write everything down. All right, that's the expectation, but it's not necessarily what happens every single time. And your final point on your primer is documents can be kept in hard copy, so literally paper documents in your hands, vintage, or electronically, so in the cloud or on a hard drive or on a disk, something like this. But they must be kept during the study, at which point they'll be added to as things go on and things happen and forms are filled out, etc., etc. And they must be stored for a period after the study ends, as set down in the law. So it could be 5 years, 10 years, 25 years. Okay?
Okay.
Is any of that new information to you, Elise?
No.
Of course not. I knew it.
I remembered all as well.
Including all of the initialisms?
Yeah.
All right. But just like we have GCP, good clinical practice, you may also not be shocked to discover that there is GDP or GDOCP, good documentation practice. When I was setting up for this episode and looking at clinical research GDP, someone on was trying to be like, oh yeah, GDP is for good distribution practice, but I never use it that way. So to me, GDP is about documentation.
Yes.
Some listeners may think good distribution practice or some other reason.
Yeah, or gross domestic product, the most commonly used acronym of GDP.
No, I don't know what you're talking about, but all of that domestic product is pretty gross.
The, you know, good documentation practice. Some people might think of good distribution practice. Uh-huh, yeah, and uh-huh. Everybody's going to think of gross domestic product.
Not me. I genuinely did not twig that that was a thing until just now. So thank you, genius Elise.
You're welcome.
You should be in charge.
I should, always.
Okay, so for the purpose of this episode, even if your brain is saying gross domestic product, I barely can even say it. Even if your brain is saying gross domestic product, you have to ignore that and think good documentation practice when I say GDP.
Got it.
All right. So GDP is a term in the pharmaceutical medical device research industries to describe standards by which documents are created and maintained. Some of these standards, some of the rules, right, are formalized in law. But there's also a lot of guidance about what makes up good documentation. From my experience as an auditor and also having been audited and inspected, this is an area where it's really easy to get findings. A finding is when a negative thing is spotted during an audit or an inspection and it's written down as a finding. It's also worth noting that some of the things that are defined as good aren't universally applied, or some of the things that are defined as bad aren't universally applied. People have different opinions about what this means. For example, I think it's the FDA who say that ditto marks or continuation lines aren't acceptable. So if you're filling out a form with a bunch of rows and the information is the same all the way down, you might do like two little dittos mm-hmm. to say, yeah, it's the same, it's the same, it's the same. And the FDA don't like that. My opinion is, frankly, I'm in a high-pressure medical setting. As long as everybody knows what that means, what difference does it make? Because it might save me a minute than having to write out whatever it is 45 times. Mm-hmm. I personally have never understood that one. But if anybody listening knows why it is and wants to tell me, I'm more than happy to be wrong. Elise?
Can I make just like a guess? This is based on literally nothing except I thought about it and I was like, this is one reason I could see. Mm. It's like, what if you're drawing that line or whatever to say like the finding was 10.0 and this is true for all of the next 20 lines and you draw that line mm-hmm. and you don't count 20 properly and you just click down to 21 and then you start your data input on line 21 instead of on line 20 and you've missed off by a line, right? You could easily, I guess that's true though, of like if you're not being careful.
You can make an error at any point. Yeah. I don't think it prevents or causes more or less errors than any other data entry method.
Just because that is a potential error it could cause does not mean that that is more likely or less likely to happen than some other error. Yeah. Got it.
And there's also a story, and I don't know the truth of this or not, that the FDA don't like you writing in blue pen.
That is a thing that is true sometimes in the US government.
Yeah, but when I spoke to an FDA inspector, like this was a few years ago now, when they were still inspecting in this country, so like maybe 10 years ago, and I asked them that, this inspector was like, yeah, I'm never going to have a problem with that. Who cares? I'm like, oh, okay. The rationale, we talked about it for a little bit, and the rationale that he gave was it might be that if you're writing in a blue, it might be that it's useful, actually, if you're writing in a blue pen because you can tell when it's photocopied, mm-hmm. whereas in a black pen, you can't. It's the same color. So I know in some situations, they actually want you to write in a blue pen mm-hmm. so that you can tell when it's photocopied. But he was very kind of, yeah, I don't think that's an issue. I don't think that's a problem. But maybe that's changed now, or maybe it was different before. The other thing about a lot of these good documentation practices, and it actually, this is the same about any kind of good practice. If it's not enshrined in law, and if it's not specifically, you must do X, a lot of the times the rules in clinical research are, the outcome should be, or you must verify that. But it doesn't tell you how to do it. And very often what you find is certain auditors or inspectors have bees in their bonnets mm-hmm. expecting it to be done a certain way when it actually doesn't need to be done that way. As long as the requirements are met, there are multiple ways to peel a potato. Okay, so there are some accepted global standards. There are some things that, taking aside the bees in bonnets of certain auditors or inspectors, there are some things that we always expect documents to do, or some standards that we always expect documents to meet. And one of the most widely accepted global standards is ALCOAC plus CEA. So
when you're saying that in the wild, how do you say it? Like to your fellow people who understand these terms, how do you say it?
I just say ALCOAC.
Okay.
Because it started back when I was in the industry 100 years ago, it started as ALCOA, which is, it's not a word, but like it kind of rolls off the tongue. Yeah. It's easy to say. Maybe it would help you remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll come on to what each of these letters stands for in a second. And then, rightly so, someone added the final C,
mm-hmm.
Alcoac. And at that point, I think we fell off the cliff of it being a useful... Is it mnemonic when it helps you remember something? Yeah. It doesn't matter. It stopped being a useful memory tool at that point. And then later, someone else added the C, E, and A, which I don't disagree with any of these letters being involved, but somebody needs to come up with a word. Like, someone mm-hmm. needs to anagram this,
mm-hmm.
because alcoaxia, it's not a word.
That sounds ridiculous, and...
It's not helpful.
Yeah, I guess here's the bee in my bonnet, is that memory tools that aren't actually useful as memory tools drive me nuts.
Well, get ready to be a little nuts then, I guess.
Okay, let's go.
All right, so alcoaxia, A-L-C-O-A-C-C-E-A.
You mean A-L-C-O-A-X-A?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, no. It's not useful as a memory tool, okay, if you can't even spell it easily.
All right, well, remember all of these words.
Okay, sure.
It says that the document... Make sure that everything that's contained within it, the data that it includes, should be attributable, legible, contemporaneous, original, accurate, complete, consistent, enduring, and available. Alcoaxia.
Clearly.
All right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's take each of those words in turn. The first A is attributable. That means you know who did it.
Yes.
So it's either signed... or initialed, or if it's done electronically, it's associated with an individual username. So you know, oh, Elise wrote that. Oh, Debbie wrote that. Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's a really useful thing, because then you know if the person that did the thing is appropriately trained and allowed and qualified to do the thing and to write down the results of the thing.
Okay, so we've got attributable.
Attributable, A.
A.
L is legible, which means you can read it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is important not only for, like, handwriting, because, lol, how good are some doctors at writing?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
sometimes a little bit scribbly. But also, like, if it's on a computer system, you have to be able to display the data in a meaningful, readable way.
Okay.
Not just the zeros and ones.
Legible. Attributable. Legible.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm learning.
Great. Yes, yes, you are. I feel like you're learning spitefully, though, and aggressively, which is even better.
Do I do anything that isn't spiteful or aggressive?
No comment, no comment. All right. The first C, contemporaneous,
mm-hmm.
which is not a word that is ever used outside of this exact
context.
Oh,
I use this word all the time, because the word modern refers to a specific era of history. And so when people say, oh, the modern whatever, I'm like, you mean modern like the, you know, the modern art history era, or do you mean like contemporaneous happening today? So listen, everything in my life is about bees in my bonnets and aggressiveness.
Yeah, yeah, and having arguments that don't need to be had demonstrably.
It's shocking. There's my dog. She's also
Riker agrees with me. She's on my side.
She's having arguments.
Shut up, Mom. Everybody knows what modern means.
She's also having arguments she doesn't need to have.
I love your dog. Okay, so attributable, legible, contemporaneous
mm-hmm.
means written at the time. And this is the one where, in my experience, you see the most errors. Because as we spoke about in episode 8, right, and multiple times, so often clinical staff are busy doing, they don't have time to be busy writing. So they might not write the thing down at the moment that it happens. They might have to write it down later. And if that happens, then they need to explain why they're writing it down later, right? This happened at the time, I just didn't write it down, blah, blah, blah.
Attributable, legible, contemporaneous.
Okay, O is original. This is what you think it is, i.e. it's the piece of paper that I've written the thing the first time onto. Which means if the first place I scroll something down is a post-it note, then that is the original record.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And a lot of the time, like, you could catch site staff out if you go, okay, well, where do you write it first? And they're like, oh, well, I just scroll it on this scratch pad and then I transcribe it across. I'm like, nope, that is the original record.
Wow.
Either you write it in the notes or you keep that original record.
Mm. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. And that's another one that people get caught out by, because they don't, like, just they just scribble something down quickly. Like, oh yeah, okay, I've got a record of it. But as soon as you transcribe, anytime you do transcription, it runs the risk of introducing error.
What if I scribble it down on, like, my water bill? Do I have to submit my water bill to the...
I don't know.
Fair enough.
I would recommend not scribbling it down on your water bill.
I know, but sometimes it's the only paper on hand.
So, in that situation, you are also allowed to have a thing called a certified copy. So ask me what that is.
Debbie, what's a certified copy?
Okay, so this is something that's defined in GCP as a copy that contains the same information, and it's certified so that somebody says, this contains the same information as the original, but it is a copy.
Who says?
So perhaps, who says? Oh, the person who certifies it. Who's the right person to certify a document? Yeah. Great question. Varies. Usually you'd expect it to be a member of site staff, but it wouldn't have to necessarily be the same member of site staff who wrote the thing. It could be like an admin member of staff taking the original record and copying them and saying, I've looked at both of them next to each other. They definitely match. And that is perhaps a way that you could do a certified copy of your water bill in that you could retract the sensitive information like your address and your billing info. And someone could add a comment, right? This information is retracted because it does not hold any relevance to the clinical study. Mm-hmm. It is a water bill for this person, right? The relevant information has been copied and I certify that it is an accurate and true copy.
Got it.
Signed and dated. So it's attributable again.
Attributable. Legible, contemporaneous, original.
Okay, the second A is accurate.
Accurate.
Which means it's correct to the right level of specificity and exact. So, like, the right number of decimal places, right, for example, as well.
Okay.
Okay, the next C is complete, which means it contains all of the necessary detail and tells the whole story.
It's cute that complete comes at the end of ALCOAC.
Right.
Except that...
Because initially it was Alcoa, and then someone went, oh, it also needs to be complete, Alcoac.
And then it's like, now the acronym is complete, except then it was not, because we've got attributable, legible, contemporaneous, original, accurate, and complete, plus SIA.
Yeah, we have. So the C of SIA is consistent. So the use of consistent mechanisms or units, and often... Like, this is used as an expectation around consistent documentation practice. So if you do something one way and you write it down that way, that you would do that consistently. Mm-hmm. And also, if information is recorded in more than one place, so if you transcribe that information, it is consistent between the two places.
Okay.
Ideally, you don't want transcription. You want there to be a single source of truth. Mm-hmm. But in some situations, like if you have the patient's weight recorded in their notes and you transcribe that onto their prescription so that the pharmacy can prepare the right dosage, you want those two numbers to match.
Okay. So when you say consistently, I'm thinking there's like two ways that I'm imagining consistency. One, I think, is the most obvious. And it's like, if I start writing things in Fahrenheit, I shouldn't switch to Celsius halfway through.
Yes, agreed. Okay.
So then the other way is like, if I start writing this by hand in black ink, do I have to continue writing it by hand in black ink, right? Or could I switch to computer input halfway through? Or is that also a violation of consistency?
No, because I think it would depend. Oh, so it would depend entirely on the document. Some documents you can only do by hand. Some documents like have to be done on a computer. But like medical notes is often a combination of both, because you'll have a typed letter from a doctor and you'll have the vital sign scribbles by the nurse onto like the actual chart if the patient's hospitalized. So it's really common that information is recorded both by hand, like pen and paper, and computer-y. That's not the right way of saying that. And by computer as well. Electronically.
Computer-mediated.
Yes, exactly, as well. And both things can and should go together to form the documentation to tell the complete full story of that patient or that study or whatever it may be. But the expectation would be if you have like a, like with the vital signs, right, you often have like a chart template and it will capture certain information, the patient's temperature, their blood pressure, their pulse, etc. If you're doing documentation consistently, you should continue to capture the same information in the same units.
Okay.
But you could absolutely switch partway through from hand to digital if your technology advances like that happens.
Okay, cool.
All right. So where were we up to, Elise?
Okay. We've got attributable, legible, contemporaneous, original, accurate, complete, consistent. And now we've got an E and an A to finish us out.
You're right. Okay, so the E is enduring.
Okay.
And this is really important, and I think this is why it came in later, is because for the first kind of 10 years of GCP being a thing, right, GCP didn't come until 1996, which seems really late in modern medical practice. And GCP initially said that you had to keep the documents for 2 years past the last marketing authorization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a marketing authorization is an application for a license to sell the drug for
okay.
a particular disease, treatment, or indication, right? You've got to keep your documents for 2 years past that point. But like, if I'm doing a phase one study now and my drug takes 10 years in development, and then I submit my drug and it takes a year or two to get reviewed, and then 2 years past that, that's easy 15 years.
Yeah.
Without even blinking. Okay. And so the documents that were created in, let's say, 1995, 15 years later, 2010, if you go back to review those documents then, are they still legible, robust? Have they faded? Have you lost mm-hmm. any information?
Okay.
Okay. So I think the reason that enduring came in is because we realised probably in about the mid-20-aughts or 2010s that some of the information that was from the early 90s wasn't still available. So enduring means that any information recorded in the documents, whether it's electronic or hard copy, lasts as long as that record retention period. And my understanding of the legislation in Europe now is it's 25 years.
Okay, wow.
Which is a long time for a piece of paper or for even for an electronic record to last.
Yeah.
Right? Because you think about computer systems. Like, if I've got something on a floppy disk now, I don't have a floppy disk reader. How do I get that stuff off there? That's the other thing that we have to think about when it comes to enduring, is making sure that we have the ability mm-hmm. to get those records off the media on which they are stored.
Okay. So as an auditor or an inspector, how do you find in the middle of it's happening now, right? We're taking these notes today. So how do we advise yes. on make this enduring?
Okay, great. So there's some really obvious and easy ones, and then there's others that are a little trickier. So for example, some ECG machines, and this may be some of the older models, but in a lot of places, these are the models that they have.
ECG?
Echocardiogram. One of the they put the
yeah, yeah.
sensors on you and it goes blip, blip, and it's multiple different mm-hmm. lines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So those often print out on thermal paper, which fades over time.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have to do with that to make sure that that information is enduring is on the day that it's done, as soon as you can after it's printed, take a copy and certify that copy.
Mm-hmm.
And then hope that the copy lasts. But actually, paper records, if they're kept in the proper conditions,
mm-hmm.
are quite enduring.
Yeah.
And we know this based on, like, we still have paper from
a
blinking long time ago.
Yes.
In the old historical archive. So the key is you have to protect these documents from the things that will break them down. So fire and flood.
Yeah.
Pests.
Mm-hmm. Exposure to sunlight.
Yep, exactly. You want to remove like staples mm-hmm. that can rust and cause breakdown in that way. And also, a lot of documents are kept in plastic sleeves
mm-hmm.
and the ink can be lifted mm-hmm. off a page if it's in a plastic sleeve. So when you prepare documents to be archived, because that's the way that we keep documents for a long time, is they go to an archive. One of the pieces of advice that sponsor companies will give to clinical sites is how to prepare their documents. And they will say, do an inventory of everything that you've got. If you've got thermal paper or anything that's looking a bit dodgy, take a certified copy straight away. Remove your staples, remove paper clips, remove plastic wallets. If there's papers that you need to group together, tie with string.
Mm.
And you need to keep those documents in a humidity-controlled area
mm-hmm.
and in an area that is protected from fire, flood, pests. So one of the things that I did back in the day when I was an auditor is I audited archiving facilities.
Cool.
Which is just basically going around a bunch of cool warehouses and asking them about their procedures for preventing fire, flood, pests, temperature control, humidity control, etc., etc. And one really cool archive that I went to is called Deep Store. It's in an old salt mine in Cheshire near where I live.
Wow.
Which was like you're way underground, and because you're underground, it's at a completely standard temperature and humidity
mm-hmm.
and it's just salt, so there's no pests. It's super cool.
That is cool.
Yeah, that was a great order. I really enjoyed that, and they were super professional as well. Right, so enduring.
Okay, so we've got attributable, legible, contemporaneous, original, accurate, complete, consistent, enduring.
And the last A is available.
Available.
Which means if I'm an auditor and inspector and I'm going to a site and I say, hey, I want these study documents from this study that you finished 5 years ago, you have to go and get me those documents and bring them to me, or go and get me those electronic records and bring them to me and make them available to me. If it's on a floppy disk or a CD or whatever, you have to make it available mm-hmm. to me. You have to work out how to do that. So that may mean calling up Deep Store and saying, hey, we need these boxes out of the archive, please. But those documents should only be made available to the right people who have the ability to access them. So auditors and inspectors, yes. And also like the study team, if they need to go back and check something as mm-hmm. well.
Anybody else? I mean, I can imagine like part of what we've talked about in the past is like you want to be able to prove to other people in the community, like the scientific community, that this is a valid research study. So like if I were a fellow scientist and I said, this stinks, can I just be like, prove it to me with your good documentation?
So I think that would depend. For sure, you could go through the legal route and subpoena.
Subpoena? Subpoena?
Yeah. I just like saying things funny. Okay. Subpoena the documents.
Okay.
Yeah, croissant.
No.
Yeah. Look, if you can't say croissant
you the just correct said
way,
it.
I'm going to okay, say was... subpoena.
Okay.
I know I said it the bad way. No, absolutely. I think you could go the legal route and you could subpoena the documents if you needed to. The difficulty is you're absolutely right in that, because we had this case, didn't we, that we talked about with that doctor who couldn't provide their original notebooks mm-hmm. to their colleagues that wanted to also do a review of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it would depend about the confidentiality of that information and that data, because you've got to think about like the patient yeah. confidentiality of it. Like, I'm not going to be sharing my patient's medical histories all over the shop with no care or attention. You've also got to think some of the information may be commercially confidential, so the sponsor may not want their protocol shared all around for someone else to copy.
Yeah.
But and also it is reasonable for scientists to want to say, hey, I don't understand how you've reached that conclusion. Can we walk through it together? And they may have to get permission from the sponsor. They may have to look only at anonymized data sets mm-hmm. in order to do that. That is less of a kind of automatic right to look at these documents than an auditor or an inspector would have.
Got it.
Good question, though. All right, so alcoaxia.
Alcoaxia.
One more time, Elise.
Okay, alcoaxia. Attributable, legible, contemporaneous. That one's going to be the problem child. I can already feel that one slipping out of my
is
head.
Is it slipping? Yeah. Is it slipping? Okay. Yeah.
Attributable, legible, contemporaneous, original, accurate, complete, consistent, enduring, available.
Amazing. Incredible.
Ask me in a few minutes.
Oh, okay. At the end, we'll come mm-hmm. back to it. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to it. All right. There are some other items that are pretty consistently used, or kind of expectations that are not necessarily universal, but pretty much, right? So, like, records must be in indelible ink because it's too easy to change a pencil entry with no one knowing.
Mm-hmm.
If there are errors, because we're all human and we all make errors, right? If something needs to be corrected, the expectation is, of course you can do that. But the original entry cannot be obscured, hidden, erased. That's why, like, pencil is just not appropriate.
Right.
You've got to use a pen. You can't scribble it out and go, oh, God, I'm ashamed. You can't cover it with correction fluid or white out. Tippex is the brand name in the UK. If you need to make a correction, you put a single line through it so you can still read the text underneath. Write the correction, initial and date it. And if you need to put an explanation as to why you're correcting it, then you put that as well. But if it's like you're correcting a spelling mistake, no worries.
Got it.
That habit is so ingrained in me. A few years ago now, I was writing a birthday card to a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, who I love dearly. And I misspelt the word birthday because I was doing it in a hurry, like running out the door yeah. to go for dinner with them or whatever. And I, without even thinking, on autopilot, single line through, correction, initial and date. And then I realised I'd done it. I'm like, oh, God, I don't have time to get another card. I can't fix this. I'm mortified.
Oh, that's so funny.
Luckily, this friend of mine at the time was, and still is actually, they still work in the industry. They're in a much, much higher powered job than me now. They're really taking over the world. They're great. But they were a CRA at the time, same mm-hmm. as I was, a monitor. And they thought that this was the most hilarious
yeah.
joke
yeah.
that anyone could make. They're like, oh, Jebby, you're a card. That's hilarious. I'm like, mm-hmm.
Yep,
mm-hmm.
That was,
and I don't think I ever told them.
That was intentional and I meant to do it.
Yep. What a good joke.
What a good joke we've made.
Lol. Yeah. Oh, God. Hilarious. Okay. So that's how you make a correction.
Mm-hmm.
All pages of documents are numbered and all pages must be present, right? You can't just lose some information because then it's not complete. And we number our pages, we, the industry, number our pages page X of Y. So page one of two, page two of two. So you always know if there's a missing page, you always know that you've got all of the pages.
Got it.
Okay. Also, this was drilled into me from like day one of working clinical research. So September 2007, day one in the office, no correction fluid, right? So no whiteout. You always number your pages this way. This is how you make a correction, single line through initial and date. And here's how you write the date. And I thought, hey now, I've got a degree. I know how to write the date. Like, calm down. But no, Elise, I did not know how to write the date. And neither do you.
Okay.
Because I, as an English person, would write the date, the day, and then the month in numbers, mm-hmm. and then the year. Okay, so the 4th of July for me is 0407, and then whatever the year is. Okay, how would you write it as a psychopath, Elise?
As an American.
That's what I said, yeah.
Yeah. We would write 07 or just 7/4/the year. Right? Yeah. Month okay, first. So
July 4th.
Yeah. Like which you doesn't read
make
it,
any sense chronologically.
Like you read it July 4th.
No, I would
4th.
Read it the 4th of July.
Yeah, but you
no.
typically you say no. July 4th, January 2nd, whatever.
No.
7,
2nd 4, of January.
2024. July 4th.
But you should put them in the order in which it's like day,
I get that. I
month.
Understand that.
You don't go hours, minutes, seconds. You don't go like minutes, hours, seconds.
But it's because you don't say 07/04/2024. You say July 4th, 2024. So when you see 07/04/2024, you will say out loud July, which is the 07, 4th, which is the 04. So there's a different reason for it. It's not only because you sort things from smallest to largest.
Okay. Well, I think most countries in the world and most people in the world at least don't agree with you.
I also don't agree with me for what it's worth.
But you were defending it so vehemently.
Yes, because okay. I grew up doing that, but I do think ultimately it makes a lot more sense.
It's wild,
to
isn't
go
it?
Day,
okay,
month,
okay, great.
Year,
look,
yeah.
I'm glad you're on my team. Great. But anyway, the point is, internationally, people write the date differently.
Yes.
And because medical research is an international thing, right, we had to have a way of writing the date that everybody could understand.
Yeah.
So we got taught, this is literally day one in the office, this is how you write the date. And it's still something now that people in the industry do. You write the date with the day, the number of the day, the month in letters, and then the year. So the 4th of July, I wouldn't even say July 4th, I'd say the 4th of July, but that's fine, would be 04JUL, and then whatever the year is. So that means that no matter if you're a normal person or an American, you know what the date is.
Okay.
Okay, good. So these rules will apply, remember, not only to paper documents, but also to electronic documents. And there are additional kind of things you have to think about with electronic records, some of which we've already touched on, right? Like the availability of media and how that will continue to work as, mm-hmm. as stuff progresses. There are also separate and strict rules about electronic signatures.
Mm.
So in some countries, it's very common to use an e-signature. In other countries, not at all, for legal reasons, right? They're not accepted.
Right.
The point is, you have to be able to prove who did the signature and when. So just as you can with a hard copy, you can, like, I can get you, Elise, to do your signature now, and I can compare it to a signature that allegedly was yours from a month ago, and I can see the date of when it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And I can compare the two. So there's got to be a way to verify, username and password usually, that it was you that did this e-cig. E-signature.
Not e-cigarette.
Finally, there's got to be a history or an audit trail maintained of changes and deletions to electronic versions. So just as with a paper copy, right, you've got your single line through your initial and date for your corrections. Similarly, if you're making changes to an electronic version, you've got to see the full story of what went on there, and nothing is obscured or hidden.
Okay.
Or lost.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, well, way back, I think issues or problems with documentation were, in my experience as an auditor, like the easiest place to find findings, because it's hard to get all of these things right across all of the hundreds and thousands of documents that you need for a clinical trial. And I went and looked on a couple of websites to see if I could get like any data on what the real common ones were. And there's tons of information out there, and I kind of fell in a little hole, mm-hmm. as I often do when I'm researching stuff, because it's interesting to me. I'm a big old nerd, sorry. But departures from GDP that have involved regulators often include: documentation is not done at the time, so it's written months later with no explanation. Can we trust it? I don't know. Use of these ditto marks, which I don't have a problem with, but some people do. Signature stamps. Now, interestingly, in some countries in the world, particularly some Asian countries, mm-hmm. it's really common to have a stamp of your signature rather than an actual signature. But in some countries, that's not legally acceptable at all. So it's one of those things that depends where you are as to whether that's acceptable or not. Obscured original data. So if I scribble something out, you can't tell what the original record is. The use of pencil, Elise, you would not believe. Or the use of whiteout.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember we were preparing for an MHRA inspection, and this was maybe like a year into my work in the company. And one of the senior directors at this company that I was working at, who was a nice guy, wasn't mean or anything, but was quite senior, came round and looked in everyone's drawers to check that nobody had Tippex. It wasn't something that you could order through like the company mm-hmm. stationery service. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that they stocked, but he came round and checked everyone's drawers because he's like, I'm not getting caught out on this. And to be fair, we didn't. It was worth it. Other items included inaccurate records, so stuff that wasn't recorded properly, and changes or corrections not being dated, so you didn't know when they happened. And here's something that I should have mentioned in the last episode when we talked about quality assurance, and we talked a lot about audits, but inspections are basically audits done by the government. For the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, the American regulator, mm-hmm. you can actually look on the FDA website to find warning letters which are sent as part of their enforcement action. So when they do an inspection or they find some stuff out, they'll send a letter to the individual or the company and say, hey, this is what you've done wrong. And they're so interesting. And this was another few hours of my life that I lost just trawling these because I'm nosy. I'll put the link to one sent to Amazon.com in December 2023 Ooh. In the show notes. A very interesting read about some of the enforcement and criminal investigations being done there. Highly recommend.
Ooh, I'll check it out.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, set aside a good few minutes. It's not a short read.
Hopefully somebody is just tearing into somebody, though.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, all the time. That's the whole point of FDA warning letters is we are warning you that you need to do something differently.
Mm-hmm.
You have done something wrong and you cannot continue to do it.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
Right. So, Elise.
Yes.
What do you remember about GDP, and what are the words that we have to remember?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not gross domestic product or good distribution practice.
Ooh, yep.
It's good documentation practice, and Alcoaxia, the most useful memory tool in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's attributable, it's legible, it's contemporaneous. It was so close to being gone. It's contemporaneous, it's original, it's accurate, complete, consistent, enduring, and available.
What a hero.
What a hero.
A real champion. Mm-hmm. Good job, Elise.
Thanks.
Yeah, well done. Absolutely. So these are the kind of rules that are really important to follow to make sure that the documentation is adequate to provide the evidence needed, right?
Mm-hmm.
To prove how a study was conducted, that everything is transparent and above board and we know what went on and nothing's hidden, nothing's secret. We've got the full story, and that full story is going to be available for the number of years it needs to be after the study ends. Interestingly, one of the best studies that I ever worked on, like literally the study ended and we're preparing for the regulatory inspections because it was the study ended and then it was immediately submitted to the regulator for them to do the approval. So we're preparing for the regulatory inspections and we got a phone call from the site staff. It was in a different country. And they're like, yeah, so what do we need to have for this inspection? We're like, oh, just all of the documents, all of the records. Oh, but we've destroyed them. What? They destroyed the whole investigator site file, like immediately after the study.
So what happened?
Yeah, well, good question. They still had, of course, all the patient notes.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that they had, we had copies of in the TMF. And then we just had to write a big, long explanation of the fact that the site had destroyed the documents inappropriately, and they got cited for that in the regulatory inspection. But because we had most of the key things in the TMF, there wasn't really anything. They still had the consent forms in the patient binders. They still had all of the patient notes, all of that data that could be verified.
Yeah.
It was just like some of the original copies of some of their things we only had photocopies of. But okay, we had a certified copy of it. Well, that's something.
Huh.
But yeah, If we had been less diligent about keeping the documents, they'd have been in serious trouble. As it was, I think they got like a strong rap on the knuckles from the regulator going, you know better than this.
Yeah. So is it kind of like almost, I mean, the thing about this is like, I want this to be enforceable too, right? Like that if somebody messes up or there you find something egregious that I can trust as a consumer of these products that like that matters.
Yeah.
You know, and so and so is it, you know, in the case of this, I hear what you're saying, like there were these backups and other things and certified copies. In the case of something even more egregious, could someone be shut down? Could the study be rendered invalid? Yep. You could say like you cannot do anything until you
this data has to be excluded from the regulatory submission. You cannot use this data to justify or to try and say anything about how that drug works. Bad luck, is excluded because we can't trust it. And that, I mean, that happens for multiple reasons, not just documentation reasons, right? Like if there's like there've been cases in front of Congress when like doctors' conduct has not been adequate. Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember the name of the drug. If I can remember, I'll put it in the show notes, where like a CRA was interviewed by Congress because she had flagged to the sponsor, to her QA department, like there's something fishy going on at this site. This is a town of 500 people and they've recruited 400 patients onto the study. Like something here doesn't add up. And it was a bit later that the FDA went in and kind of got to the bottom of the problem and there was some fraud going on, and the FDA like chucked out all of that data.
Wow,
which is the right thing to do, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. And what the sponsor hopes is that that data isn't the critical data that proves that their drug statistically works or doesn't work. Like if you throw out 500 patients worth of data, that could be a breaking point for, and now I don't have enough data to prove that my drug works.
Right, you need your N, your number of participants, to be high enough, and if you just cut out one doctor's worth of patients, maybe it's enough still and maybe it's not to still prove what you need to prove statistically.
Yeah, so you should be reassured that in cases like that, appropriate action is taken.
Yeah.
And that there are, as I've said before multiple times, right, there are fail-safes, there are backups, there are situations like this where even if the site destroys all of the documents, we still have most of the information available that we can still reconstruct the vast majority of the study.
Right. And I imagine like in that case, if the amount that had been destroyed was past a certain tipping point, it would have also kind of met the same end of like, well, we can't actually use this now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just trying to find out if I can find what that drug was. I know if I boot up my work computer, I can find it. Nah. Oh, that's annoying. I can't find it. I know it's on that computer. I just can't be bothered to boot that up. Never mind. All right. Oh, Elise, I should ask, do you have any further questions?
No, I don't think I do.
Okay, then we hope you enjoyed listening to our podcast. If you have any questions or would like to get in touch with us, you can email us at clinical.research.intro@gmail.com. Elise is dancing to my rhythmic talking. Please do subscribe so you can get the next episode automatically. Of course, please rate and review. You can also check out the Clinical Research 101 Instagram page at clinical.research.intro on Instagram. Our website, you should check it out. It's super cool. Elise has all the praise for that one, not me. That's at intro2clinicalresearch.podbean.com. There's other information there, including transcripts. Finally, a big thank you from us to our marvellous friend, Sam Winnie, for letting us use their incredible music for our intro and outro. Thanks and goodbye from me, Debbie. Say goodbye, Elise.
Goodbye, Elise.
Goodbye,
Elise. Goodbye, Debbie.